for the latest legal insights in sport, welcome to the Charles Russell Speechless Podcast, The Score.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest instalment of The Score podcast series from the sports team here at Charles Russell Speechless, where we enjoy discussing and diving into some of the hot topics right now in the world of sport. And today we're going to be talking about how esports and virtual sports are filling the gaps left by the cessation of traditional sports as the country and indeed the world finds itself in the grip of the COVID-19 virus. We're obviously all recording this from different locations. Thank you to our listeners for bearing with us. With me today, I'm very pleased to have my colleagues Jody McDonald and Richard Davies. Hello, guys. I hope you're both doing well.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Rich. Very good, thanks.
How's the beard coming on, Rich?
In quarantine for 3 weeks, so coming through strongly.
Very glad to hear it. So, yeah, Rich and Jody and I are all members of the sports team and part of the diverse group at Charles Russell Speechless. And we've been keeping a very close eye on what's been happening in recent days and weeks in the world of sport, and perhaps more accurately, what hasn't been happening, because it's been a strange old month or so. So let's just sort of dive in, guys, and talk a little bit about, well, what has been going on out there. How have traditional sports been trying to cope with this fact that live events basically have been completely stopped around the world, effectively? Jody, do you want to dive in on that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Nick. So yeah, I mean, I'll start by just talking about a sport that's particularly close to my heart, which is motorsport, and what's been happening around the world of motorsport in the kind of online virtual esports sector. Well, as you say, we have this strange hiatus where, of course, all the real world events are currently cancelled. So I think it's fair to say that some of the most successful examples we've seen of esports filling the gap left by traditional sport in the last few weeks have actually come from the world of motorsport. I mean, one of the first out of the blocks was actually a UK esports organization called Veloce Esports. Veloce manage a number of the top professional gamers and content creators in the world of virtual racing. And they also have strong relationships in the traditional side of motorsport as well. But they were very quick to react when the Australian Grand Prix was cancelled back in mid-March. It was a very, if you recall, it was very last-minute decision by F1 to cancel that race. And in fact, all the teams and drivers, etc., were already out in Melbourne ready to go when they actually pulled the plug due to concerns about coronavirus, etc., obviously. And in a very short period of time, something incredible like 48 hours, Veloce had effectively created a live online event called Not the Oz GP, which was streamed on their Twitch and YouTube channels. And they really stole a march on the more established rights holders and other parts of the F1 world, who were, you know, perhaps understandably had their hands full dealing with the fallout from the cancellation of the real race. But Veloce effectively mobilized their network of professional gamers, content creators, and also wrote in some real life F1 stars to take part in this not the Oz GP. And it was a very, very successful event, and it was, you know, swiftly followed then by a host of other esports and virtual events within the world of motorsport, eventually from the likes of F1 themselves, with their virtual GP series. In the States, you have NASCAR are doing it, MotoGP, even individual racing teams are now getting on this on the bandwagon. So, I mean, that's been really interesting to see. I mean, the events vary quite a lot in terms of the format and what game they're played on. And it tends to feature a mix of current real-world racing drivers, some retired legends from the past, and interestingly, also athletes from other sports. And I think that kind of cross-pollination is something we'll perhaps touch on a bit later in the podcast as well. But as I say, they've been very successful. The NASCAR event was, in fact, I think, the most watched esports event on US linear TV in history. They've helped to keep motorsport in the public consciousness during this kind of hiatus period. They've created, you know, millions of column inches of positive press coverage for everyone around the sport. I think they have been a huge success. I think, you know, again, we're going to touch on later what that means going forward. But certainly, in a very short period of time, if you're a motorsport fan, you know, I'm sure lots of there was an existing community of people that were already very into virtual racing games and esports in this sector. But I think for a lot of other fans, you know, this in the last few weeks, they've tuned in and watched their first ever, you know, esports events, watching these races, and they've seen that there's real skill involved, there's incredible entertainment and action. And I think, you know, once you've opened that door now, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out in the future.
Yeah, okay. And I think with these kind of racing games, it's quite easy in a way to create an experience that is perhaps unusually close to the actual event itself. So, you know, the experience obviously being in a real F1 car is going to be welcome. I'm sitting at home and playing the Codemasters game. But at the same time, you know, the fan can really watch and engage with very, very good gamers or drivers playing these games and getting really good, almost lifelike feeling, which may be a bit harder with some of the other sports. But Rich, have you got some examples for us from outside the world of motor racing?
I think it's been really interesting to talk about another surge in online gaming activity in the last few weeks, resulting from a lot of people being stuck at home and looking for alternative forms of entertainment. But I think it's important to recognise, as we talk about that, a huge amount of online gaming activity happens all the time. You know, there's a huge gaming community out there, professional esports scene every week. And I think what we've seen recently has been a huge surge in maybe the mainstream media's focus on it, and, you know, potentially, you know, the number of participants and viewers for these events. I already showed you that this was a mainstream activity. So I think part of what we're seeing is a renewed focus on what's already happening. But I think, you know, from the perspective of some of the traditional sports, what's really interesting over the last few weeks is some of the new events which have happened, as Jodie was talking about, the MotoGP series, you know, brand new event that's really taken off. And some of the attempts of these the sports are using to try and fill the void, as it were. So I'll sort of highlight three examples that are out there at the moment. The first is one which is going on over the last couple of days and right now is the NBA 2K Players Tournament. So the NBA 2K, that's a basketball game which is hugely successful. And while the NBA has been suspended, the tournament has been established to have 16 of the current real-life players playing in a video game tournament. And that's been broadcast on ESPN in the States, and it's gaining an awful lot of interest as a charitable angle to it as well, as raising money for various charities. You know, because they've got some of the real life stars of the game participating, again, that's driving interest from people who may not be the traditional audience or players of the game. And one interesting point about that is that the NBA 2K series already has a pro esports league, and they're pro gamers and not NBA players playing it, but it's a standalone league of its own which already carries on. And rather interestingly, it's actually been postponed due to the coronavirus outbreak itself.
So the NBA 2K tournament, players tournament, is one way that they can drive content during the sort of downtime. And similarly, in Spain, the Liga players have been competing in a tournament just a couple of weeks ago, a FIFA 20 tournament and football simulation. So rather than through an eSport standalone video game title, these are the sort of virtual sports simulation sports title. A tournament which was competed in by a number of La Liga players. It was actually won by Real Madrid's Marco Asensio, and it had backing from official La Liga partners, so Santander and EA Sports, and EA Sports being the obviously the publisher of FIFA. So they sort of had a quasi-official status to that tournament. And then the third one I mentioned is an event which around 5 million people in the UK watched this weekend, which is the Virtual Grand National. So again, a very different type of gaming virtual event. This isn't an elite sport in any way, but it's a virtual version of a national. And that was broadcast on ITV1, which, you know, is a huge statement in itself that a virtual event could gain enough interest to A, be put on ITV1, B, obtain the sort of media coverage that it did in advance to drive people to watch it, and C, you know, achieved a peak audience figure of 4.8 million people. So yeah, that was down on in comparison to the actual race figures last year, but obviously a huge interest in a purely virtual event. So yeah, those are just three examples of what's going on out there in various sports. But you know, I think obviously there's more of this type of content in the pipeline due to the current blackout of live events.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're talking there about the FIFA game and what La Liga were doing, and as a Spurs fan, I have to mention the Ryan Sessegnon and Mikel Antonio game that they played, a game of FIFA Online, which Ryan Sessegnon emerged victorious in. And, you know, this is where we draw out the distinction, isn't it, between esports and gaming. You know, what these guys, you know, this isn't really esports, which is sort of playing games professionally, but it's basically, you know, two celebrities, two footballers playing a virtual version of the game together, and that inevitably generates interest from the footballers and their team's fan bases, and you know, the attention that garners is all the more kind of marked during this period when there literally is no football at all. And you also mentioned a really interesting point about, you know, I think there is this, perhaps this impression in some quarters that the various different esports can just crack on during this COVID-19 crisis, and they'll be unaffected because it's all online, whereas the reality is that they are going to be massively disrupted as well, because, you know, the biggest esports events tend to be LAN events that take place, you know, before very significant audiences and crowds.
Yeah, I think just one good example of that is the LEC League of Legends Europe tournament, or league, which is run by Riot Games, and all the games in that professional esports tournament are held in a studio in Berlin. Teams fly in from various locations around Europe every Friday. And you know, the reason for that in pro esports is it's technical. As you said, the LAN events are needed from low latency. Any light can affect the gameplay. So, and also the production of those events, so they are produced to a really high standard, as you would expect with professional events. And so the broadcast of those is produced. And now those events are taking place remotely. They've had to adapt, and there's been some teething problems with that. And so, yeah, I think the big advantage for professional esports is that they can keep the show on the road, they can carry on, even though there are a number of technical challenges to that. But yeah, it's certainly not the case that that esports can just carry on as ever they were without any impacts. And you said the live events that get the community together, they do face significant challenges.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on and let's talk a little bit about some of the legal implications or complexities around what we're seeing in terms of, you know, some of this esports gaming content, you know, perhaps replacing in some respect the traditional live sports content. obviously on this podcast, what we're focusing on is more on this kind of sports simulation games, inevitably, because they obviously replace, you know, the likes of the Codemasters F1 game or EA's FIFA game. You know, they replace football and F1 and so on more straightforwardly than anything like a Call of Duty or a League of Legends would. But just to take one example that I found interesting is around in-game advertising. So, you know, in some of these sports simulation games, you do have advertisers and sponsors branding within those games. And those advertisers or sponsors aren't necessarily going to be the advertisers or sponsors of the actual F1 events or, you know, of the actual stadia or teams that might be represented within those games. But there's an interesting kind of rights issue there, is, you know, when a club or a team or a governing body is doing sponsorship or advertising deals, to what extent do they kind of bundle together the rights in respect of the relevant sort of simulation game to that sponsor? You know, do they bundle them together or do they split them out? So I just thought that's just one interesting example of the complexities around some of the commercial rights for some of these events. And Rich, I think you had some points about sort of media and broadcast rights.
Yeah, I think the key point on the media rights for these virtual events is it's just a completely different structure and model to the usual structure that rights holders will be familiar with from with their live events. So the first issue being who is actually the rights holder and what right rights do they have. So for example, you take an example of, say, a FIFA title, who actually has the right to put on the tournament using the FIFA video game? Would the Premier League do it? Is it reserved to EA Sports? Can individual football clubs do it? Third-party tournament organisers? So there are a number of issues there, and depending on each sport, and one of the first questions would be, even is there a title that sport can exploit, which a virtual version of their sport or otherwise. So the first question being, you know, who has the right to use the game and what rights do they have? And that can vary from publisher to publisher, and depending on whether it's an official game and the deal that's been done with the publisher from the sports organisation to, you know, what rights they have to run tournaments using the title. And, you know, then the broadcast angle or the distribution, who can actually put that out there and what can they do with it? What's very typical in esports will be individual gamers streaming them playing the event or playing the title, which again, you know, the sort of diversity of broadcast streams is something which rights holders from the traditional sports world will be less familiar and comfortable with. You know, typically the rights holders deals we do are about controlling the production, controlling the feed, and controlling who has access to it. Whereas, you know, the content which is by virtual events can often be individual streams. So one example for the virtual events, Lando Norris, who did an F1 drive, who couldn't actually join the event due to technical problems, but he then hosted a streaming party of the event. So he broadcasting it on his own Twitch feed, watching the event, and added over 100,000 live streams, his personal stream of him watching the event. That would be a very, very unusual position to have in any traditional sporting event. So the models here are different. And also the sort of issue with different rights that organisations have. So the La Liga players tournament that I mentioned, that was broadcast by Spanish TV and also streamed by various media organisations, so sort of, you know, more non-exclusive type arrangements. And the point being here that, you know, particularly in this environment, these events are trying to achieve reach rather than value. That's always the tension that sport have when distribution of rights is being talked about is, do you try and reach the most number of people, or are you trying to maximise value? And typically here, yeah, the sports are not trying to make money from these events in the short term, but these events behind paywalls and monetize it. That's not what they're trying to achieve here. It's about trying to reach as many people and keep your fan base engaged. So there's a model which, yeah, an awful lot less control and a lot more freedom, which is based on some really interesting methods of distribution and differences, which, you know, some of these rights holders may in the future look at the what they're doing here and think that, you know, potentially there's an avenue for their more traditional company.
Yeah, and there's a real question, isn't there, around to what extent are these different methods of distribution of content dependent on or driven by the respective ages and profiles of the audience. So, you know, we have this idea that the traditional sports audience, you know, the people who tune in to watch live football, for example, or cricket, you know, this is an older demographic, and they are used to having, you know, this model of there's a single exclusive broadcaster who produces a high quality, you know, broadcast feed of that match and enjoys exclusivity for that. But yeah, the contrasting idea that, you know, amongst the younger generations, they're just not so interested in doing that, and they're more interested in seeing, well, how is my favourite participant or my favourite gamer, my favourite influencer, how are they covering this, how are they getting involved in it? So yeah, there is certainly a way in which this distinction is being categorised as one between different generations. So it'll be interesting to watch in the years and probably decades to come how that plays out. But Jodie, you had some points as well around the betting aspects of some of this. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So obviously betting companies are used to being able to offer punters multiple options for events to bet on pretty much 24/7 these days, or certainly they were prior to all the disruption caused by the coronavirus crisis. So, you know, real world live sports events are pretty much, with a few exceptions, completely on hold. I think currently they are still playing some league football out in Belarus and potentially Costa Rica, but other than that, there's not a lot going on. So naturally, those betting companies are seeking out other options at this time. And you know, some of the esports events we're talking about are definitely attracting interest from betting markets. As are, in fact, you know, the area of virtual sports or virtual games, similar to what Richard was talking about in terms of the virtual Grand National. Virtual games have been around in betting for a long time, but, you know, during this crisis, you are starting to see more rights holders getting involved and, you know, licensing official IP to some of these virtual games that are being used to plug the content gap. In terms of the esports events themselves, you know, if there's interest from betting markets, then there is possibly a revenue opportunity there for the event organisers themselves in terms of all the normal revenue streams around betting, whether that's taking betting sponsorship, providing data from the events, either pre-match in terms of, you know, lineups and participant lists, or live data during the events, and then obviously a video stream. Although, as we've said before, the model here is that really the live streams are generally sort of freely available, so there's probably a bit less value in terms of betting streaming rights and some of these things, albeit there is still some value because a betting operator will like to have the option of having being able to serve a stream directly within their own app or website to punters that happen to be on there anyway. So, you know, all of these things are opportunities. I mean, in terms of from the perspective of the events themselves, the usual caveats apply in terms of
them needing to make sure that if they choose to engage commercially with the betting industry, they have to do that on a responsible basis, make sure they've got their house in order in terms of the integrity of the competition, to the extent they can control that. And if they're advertising, betting brands through sponsorship, there's obviously a host of law and regulation around how you need to go about doing that, which is particularly an area to be careful of around esports with such a young audience generally for these events. So I think that's some of the issues around betting. I think the other one, I mean, obviously Nick's touched on sponsorship, and I agree it's a fascinating element to this. I mean, if you take F1 again, the F1 2019 game, Codemasters game that's being used in lots of events, it's effectively a year out of date now. So the 2020 game won't be released until, doesn't normally come out until June. So you've actually got old sponsors in that game, and obviously that creates a bit of a challenge for teams that may have had a change to title sponsor, for example, in the last few months of this season. So that's a really interesting element to it. The other thing we've seen is that from an athlete point of view, thinking about endorsements or sponsorships, an athlete might have the same bear traps apply in the world of esports as they do in the world of real sports. So it was actually during one of the NASCAR esports events that a driver effectively rage quit the game halfway through when he was crashed into by a competitor. So rage quitting is a pretty well-known phenomenon in the world of esports, but effectively it just means somebody having a tantrum and quitting the game. And this driver effectively did that along with a whole bunch of exclusives that were put out on his live stream. So fairly embarrassing for him. But also one of his sponsors effectively dropped him after the event, saying that they don't want to be associated with that sort of behaviour. So, it's just an interesting reminder that all of these issues continue to play out in the virtual world, in the esports world, that is now so much more prominent during this hiatus of normal sports. So, thinking about it from a sort of lawyer's perspective, morality clauses in sponsorship and endorsement agreements is something which we all deal with on a regular basis. Obviously, they can become very heavily negotiated. I think in esports, it's an area where it does sort of warrant special consideration, because the whole gaming community and esports community is a bit different to traditional sport. It's very irreverent. There's lots of effectively what some might refer to as friendly banter that goes back and forth, things that you need to acknowledge that as a brand if you're looking to associate yourself with some of these events, you need to acknowledge that. I mean, at the same time, certain behaviour is obviously just not acceptable no matter what context you're in. But I think, it's some of that is definitely worth special consideration within esports.
Yeah, and I think that it's just reminded me of this point about, because I think a lot of people from within the sports world kind of assume that, those people who are involved in esports are super keen for the world of sports to get interested in them and to engage with them and to sort of cross pollinate audiences and so on. Whereas the reality is certainly for many, and there are very many different esports communities, but certainly for many of them, they don't really care about sports, and they're not, the whole debate about whether the International Olympic Committee, decides to try and experiment and bring an element of esports into the Olympics. It's not an issue for them whether sports engages with them or not. That's just one interesting point around, some of the perceptions of esports within the traditional sports communities. But I think we're getting towards the end of this podcast. But one thing that
I think we have to, Brian, address really is what's going to happen, you know, when the sport does resume. We don't know, you know, when matches are going to start to be played again and when events are going to be rescheduled for. But there is this sort of fundamental question which can be sort of put in quite strident terms, you know, do we just go back to normal or has everything changed? The answer inevitably will be somewhere in the middle. You know, my own take on it, and I'll ask each of you for yours before we sign off, but my suspicion, and this may be slightly controversial, but I think for the most part we will be going back more or less to business as usual, you know, in terms of how rights are packaged and sold and exploited. But I think that is within the context of this constant kind of gradual evolution that is taking place in terms of, you know, moving towards clips and shorter form content and more snackable content, if you like. But I think, you know, we are going to go back pretty much to where we were probably a few months ago, but we will have collectively, you know, this newfound appreciation of the fragility of live sports, and we will have an appreciation for sort of the relative robustness at the same time of esports and virtual sports and sports or sports simulations that can be played out online. So business as usual, but with a newfound appreciation of how fragile live sports really is probably my message. So what about you, Rich?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting take. I think in some ways it's too early to tell what business as usual looks like for traditional sports. So the impact of the shutdown will really depend on how long it lasts for, and you know, potentially a number of other things. So, you know, what's the impact on broadcast partners? The interesting businesses which have been supporting some of the media rights deals in the last few years, the likes of the Zone in the States particularly, and then the traditional broadcasters in other parts of the world paying big media rights fees. How that model stands up by the end of this crisis remains to be seen. So I think what business as usual looks like, irrespective of these forces / gaming angle, is still too early to tell, and there could be some really significant changes for the industry if this shutdown lasts for a significant period of time. But I think in terms of the gaming angle particularly, inevitably it will help esports in the short, medium and long term to get the level of exposure and you know, new audiences being driven to the content. Now, I with apologies to whoever made this comment, I can't recall where I read it, but I heard that, you know, the coronavirus shutdown could be to esports what Italia 90 was to football, that it brings it out into the open, brings it into the mainstream, and really sort of got rocket fuel under the whole industry. Now, you know, I think if people, you know, the wider sports audience who aren't currently watching or if they're aware of online gaming and esports as a entertainment property, they start becoming more educated, watching these events, and seeing it more than a novelty. So Katie was talking about the betting angle. You know, if people become sufficiently interested, want to watch these events time again and consume them, then that can only drive the industry forward. And you know, some of the platforms that people now be becoming familiar with, so Twitch, you know, is the platform for consuming esports, but currently there is no reasonable alternative to that, you know, with the same rich functionality to watch traditional sports. Amazon is the owner of Twitch. You know, they have the rights to a number of the Premier League matches. Now, will that cause a drive for Amazon to put their content through the Premier League content through Twitch the next time that these rights comes around because of the familiarity that people will have, and also the fact that they once they see how rich the functionality of the Twitch platform is, they won't want to go back to a sort of main screen and second screen type consumption. I think that could be one big change. I think another one will be athletes and content creators. As more athletes are doing their own streaming and creating their own content in a world where they don't have the same sports content we used to, then that will only accelerate the trend which we've already been seeing. And those with really great personalities and who are doing some really good work at the moment, whether it's charitable or in engaging their own fan base, and that will again be focused on in the next few months. So clearly when traditional sports get going again, virtual sports won't have the same profile of free run at media time and the attention that people have. So the virtual Grand National is not going to receive the same attention next year. So, but the fact that people have watched it this year can only mean that the likelihood of them knowing what this is and potentially going back for more has got to be increased. So, I think I'm cautious and hedging my bets as to just how big an impact that this will have.
All right, brilliant. Thanks for that. That's some very interesting thoughts in there, Rich. Jodie, to round this off, some final thoughts.
Yeah, no, I agree. Once events come back, they will reclaim their place as the kind of flagship products for lots of sports bodies. But I do genuinely think that in some cases, the role that esports will now play in the sort of content mix is going to be changed forever. So, obviously all sports are desperately trying to, and have been for a number of years now, trying to find ways to produce enough content to keep fans engaged and interested in the gaps between their events. And I think, for the sports that are able to translate easily to an esports version of themselves and that have capitalized on this opportunity now during the hiatus period to get that esports parallel version out to mainstream fans, I think they will see that those fans have had their eyes opened and they will be interested or certainly more interested now in the esports versions of their favorite sport than they were before. I don't think I think that's a real sea change that will not see that won't won't go backwards from there. So the opportunity is then there to create something long term around that. So that's what I think for traditional sports. I mean, the other thing is that a lot of this is put a spotlight on the traditional sports around the importance of technology and specifically sort of content production, remote production facilities, and that sort of thing. I think some sports have shown themselves to be better equipped than others in that regard, and I think lots of anyone that's looking at their strategy more closely in the next few months will be asking themselves where they're at in that regard and whether they need to make some investment or set up some partnerships for the future so that they're a bit better placed for that kind of thing. I think for any of the esports events that we've mentioned that are based on real sport, I think what will change for them when we go back to normal, as it were, is that obviously you won't have so many of the real world stars with as much free time on their hands. The ones that do gain in their free time will probably still be interested in taking part in these events, but a lot of them, there will be a drop off in that regard. So I think it's important if anyone wants to have a long term success around an esports version of their sport, they need to really be concentrating on the professional gamers and the content creators, making those guys the story, building their profiles, making them the stars of the show. Because when the real world stars are back out there competing on the pitch or the track or wherever it might be, they'll be less available. And then, finally, maybe just to wrap it up, is one thing I mentioned, which I think is really interesting, is this. The way some of these events that have been taking place have shown us the benefits of sort of cross-pollination, so between sports.
and we've seen the likes of, going back to the motorsport example, we've seen the likes of, you know, Ian Poulter, Thibaut Courtois, Ben Stokes, you know, competing in some of the F1 racing games that have been going on. And I think that's a really interesting sort of sports marketing trend that, I mean, there's always been examples of this in the past, and I think sports fans love it, but it's only now coming into focus just how effective some of these cross-pollination can be. And I do think esports is a great way for, you know, in a slightly more lighthearted environment, for someone from outside a sport to take part and to, you know, show themselves to fans in other sports. And I think something we'll probably see a lot more, not clear exactly yet how that's going to manifest itself going forward, but I for one thing, it's a great sort of development, and one that there's a lot more sort of mileage in it in terms of how it can be used.
Fantastic. All right, well, Jodie McDonald, Rich Davies, thank you both very much indeed. We hope the quality has been bearable. We hope you found it enjoyable and informative. And if you have any questions, be sure to get in touch with us. And we will see you next time for the next episode of The Score. And thank you very much for listening. All the best.